I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, in advance of the annual walk to combat Alzheimer's, we're going to talk about the disease and how it affects Indiana. We'll discuss challenges and solutions. My guests are Sarah Bradley with the Walk to End Alzheimer's, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Indiana, Natalie Sutton, and Dr. Mary Guerrero-Ostrom. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about Alzheimer's disease today on No Limits. The hook for the show is the annual walk to end Alzheimer's. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Sarah Bradley. She is with the Walk to End Alzheimer's. Natalie Sutton, who is the Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Indiana. And Dr. Mary Guerrero-Ostrom from the IU School of Medicine. It's good to have all of you here.
Thanks for having us.
Certainly. So let's start first. We'll do the logistical piece of this, Sarah, and we will talk about the walk. When is it and what is involved?
I will actually let Natalie take that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You'll let Natalie. All right.
I will.
Well, the Walk to End Alzheimer's in Indianapolis is Saturday at Bankers Life Fieldhouse. Registration opens at 9 a.m., and we have a beautiful opening ceremony at 10:30 a.m. We're expecting between 4,000 and 5,000 participants to join us, and it's a very meaningful day for our association. It's the largest expression of community support for our mission, and it's a time when people who are on a very lonely journey can come together and celebrate this mission together and really come together with their hope for the future for a world without Alzheimer's disease.
How many people do you anticipate will show up?
Last year we had about 4,500, and we're thinking we'll have 4,000 to 5,000 again this year.
Wow. And you hope for good weather, right?
We always hope for good weather.
Rain,
yes.
All of that.
That's where I draw the line, though. I can't plan that.
So, Mary, I'm going to throw the next one to you. We probably ought to, Alzheimer's is one of those terms that gets thrown around, but we probably ought to define it and involve the people who... I have this drill in the classroom where I tell students, because some people are embarrassed not to acknowledge that they don't know something.
Oh, sure.
That, you know, if you don't understand what I'm talking about, please, no, not put your hands up. Look down at the floor right now so that they're not embarrassed by that. And I know that I've got to go ahead and explain it. So everyone who's out there right now, if you don't understand what Alzheimer's is, look down to the floor and Mary will explain.
Okay. Thanks, John. Yeah, it's... It is thrown around a lot. I think the increase in awareness and open discussion about these disorders has really helped, you know, increase this. And events like the Walk to End Alzheimer's, we see it everywhere. But you're right, often we're not sure. I think the most common question I get is really, what is dementia and what is Alzheimer's? Because they're often thrown around together. Mm-hmm. So I think what's useful for our listeners to understand is dementia is kind of the umbrella syndrome or cluster of symptoms called dementia. And then under that, if you think about it as an umbrella, each spoke is a different cause of that dementia. And Alzheimer's takes up about 50 to 70% of the umbrella. So a very common cause of these symptoms of dementia, which include short-term memory loss, confusion, problems with reasoning, judgment, calculation. We call them the higher executive functions of the brain. Mm-hmm. That will tend to be lost first. So it's a disorder of cognition or of neurocognition, thoughts and processes, and eventually actions, functions as well. So it is one, the major cause of executive dysfunction or cognitive disorders is Alzheimer's disease. Others include dementia of the vascular type. So anything related to stroke, heart disease. We used to call it hardening of the arteries. So circulatory problems are a second to Alzheimer's disease.
What distinguishes the two? How do you tell the difference?
Good question. So if it is a vascular event that caused this, families or the key informant, the husband, the patient themselves sometimes can say, I was okay until March the 12th, 2017. And so we know something happened.
There was an event.
Usually a stroke, some kind of infarct, something happened on March the 12th, whereas Alzheimer's type dementia is very, we say, insidious. One family member will say, well, remember the time mom did X or last Thanksgiving, you know, she had everything ready, but the turkey was still frozen. So planning a complex meal. And then somebody will say, yes, but the time she couldn't remember how to get to her sister's house was 6 months before that. So there's all these little things that add up to a history of these symptoms getting worse. And then a good physician will say, based on this history and everything you've told me and, you know, some blood work and a brain image, this is probably an Alzheimer's type dementia.
So, Sarah and Natalie, I'm presuming even if there are families or friends who are dealing with people who are battling dementia that is not Alzheimer's, you will still welcome their presence at the walk.
Absolutely. Yes, and the Alzheimer's Association, we have a variety of care and support services. We serve families and individuals with all types of these diagnoses. So sometimes the care path or the experience can be similar, even though it's a different cause. And we really have some expertise and tools and resources for people that apply in either case.
And may I
add something?
So having been involved in the community for over 3 decades now, I hate to admit that, except to say...
It gets worse, don't worry.
Except to say I was 12 when I started.
All right.
It's the Alzheimer's
Association. We'll call you Doogie Howser
forward. Right. But the association is known as the Alzheimer's Association and Related Disorders. We often knock that off for ease of saying, you know, mouthful there. But we really, and I say that we lovingly, having served on their board and the national board, we do look at that whole dementia syndrome and all of the disorders that fall under that. We will embrace them all.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Alzheimer's in anticipation of this Saturday's walk to end Alzheimer's. If you want to join the conversation, please call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I want to talk a bit about how many Hoosiers, how many people are affected by this. And I'm going to throw that one to Natalie first because she made the mistake of making eye contact. But
there are more than 5.7 million Americans living with Alzheimer's or dementia, and that includes 110,000 Hoosiers. We use the term living with Alzheimer's or dementia because in many cases, those individuals may not have a formal diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So that is an estimated number based on those who are living with Alzheimer's or some form of dementia.
Are we confident in the, you know, in the validity of the estimates? Because you mentioned the fact, and we're anticipating a line of questioning here that you set up by mm-hmm. by calling it a lonely journey. This is one of those things that that people often don't talk about or don't reveal. Sarah's nodding her head. I'm going to be bringing that back to her in a sec, as I suspect she's got a story to tell.
No, you're very correct in that. We feel fairly confident in the numbers. Our organization does an annual review of facts and figures and numbers from all different sources. So we do believe that that 110,000 is a fairly good estimate, but we are really working to raise awareness so that when people notice something's wrong or when their families notice something's wrong, they seek an understanding of what's happening and a diagnosis. And some people will say to us, why? There's nothing I can do if I have Alzheimer's disease. There's no cure. But there are a lot of things you can do. There are resources, as I mentioned earlier, that the association or other entities offer to support people. But there are things you can do in terms of planning, in terms of family members, modifying their behaviors to be supportive of the person living with the disease, and ultimately to perhaps change your care journey in the way that you can live the rest of those years as you wish. And so we're very big proponents of recognizing what we call 10 warning signs of Alzheimer's disease or dementia, and seeking out that diagnosis when you know something might be wrong.
Sarah, why were you nodding your head as emphatically as you were?
So I am, I have a personal tie to Alzheimer's, as my mom was diagnosed with dementia at 58. So I have been a family caregiver for her over the course of the last 6 to 7 years, dealing with the day-to-day struggles of a person who, like she said, started forgetting small things. And unfortunately, we did not seek the early diagnosis, and we didn't have those resources. I didn't know about the Alzheimer's Association in the early stages of her diagnosis. And so I wish that I would have had those resources when we were first seeing the signs for her.
I'm going to stay with you for a couple, because I think this is hearing people's personal stories is mm-hmm. important. Because just telling the story lends a dignity to it, and I think that's valuable in mm-hmm. and of itself. But also, it will help other people. How large a family are you from?
As far as my siblings,
yeah,
it's me and then two sisters.
Two sisters. Mm-hmm. You'll understand why I'm asking this in a bit. When did you first begin noticing the signs with your mother?
I think it really started earlier than we tend to believe that it did. My father passed away 15 years ago last month. After that, she had got a job, and she was making mistakes at her job that didn't make sense. Probably 6 years after that, she had accidents at work where they said she needs to see a neurologist. We think that there's something else going on. And so she went to a neurologist, and they diagnosed her then with dementia, forgetting to pay for her cell phone bill. I know I paid it. Mm-hmm. Forgetting how to go to places where she should know where she's going. She's been there a million times, and she would get turned around. And so things that didn't seem like, oh, definitely she has dementia, but thinking back on it, were signs pointing to her diagnosis.
What I want to get at, and the reason I asked how many members of your family, is at least, and there is a member of my extended family who is living with dementia as well. It's been my observation that there's often a reluctance to talk about it, to say, you know, no one wants to be the first daughter to say, I think something's not right
mm-hmm.
with mom.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the case in your family?
I think that for all of us, we kind of felt that way, where we didn't want to accept where she was. But I think the hardest for us was taking away her car. Her sense of independence and driving, because we didn't want to believe that she was as bad off as what she was. And that was probably the biggest struggle on all three of our part. My older sister, I have an identical twin sister, so my older sister kind of took the lead as far as power of attorney, making those sorts of decisions. But all three of us are very involved in her care now. But she was definitely the one when my mom still had a lot more cognitive ability to be the bad guy, to be the one to make the doctor's appointments and to enforce the rules. And so my mom would get angry with her a lot of times because she didn't feel like we were being fair to her. She didn't feel like she had the dementia or the Alzheimer's. And so, yeah.
And that's tricky. Was it a moment? Was it your first sort of acknowledgement of this? And we're running up on time. We can finish mm-hmm. the story on the other side of the break. Maybe that actually would be wiser. I will present the question when we get to the other side of the break, because it's kind of a complicated
okay.
one. If you are just joining us, we are talking about Alzheimer's in anticipation of this Saturday's Walk to End Alzheimer's. My guests are Sarah Bradley with the Walk to End Alzheimer's, Natalie Sutton, who is Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Indiana, and Dr. Mary Guerrero Ostrom of the IU School of Medicine. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Alzheimer's in anticipation of the annual Walk to End Alzheimer's. My guests are Sarah Bradley with the Walk to End Alzheimer's, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Indiana, Natalie Sutton, and from the IU School of Medicine, Dr. Mary Guerrero Ostrom. So before we went to the break, Sarah, what I wanted to, because I think this is the part that's going to hit home and bring it to a real level and make the numbers seem real. When you were talking with your sisters, I'm presuming that did you first sort of arrive at the conclusion that your mother would be dealing with Alzheimer's, living with Alzheimer's or dementia? When you got the diagnosis from the neurologist, or were there a series of conversations among the sisters before that moment?
Oh, there was absolutely a series of conversations. We'd not dealt with that, and we were honestly not expecting to deal with that at her young age. You know, 56, 57 years old, you don't typically think that those are the signs towards the dementia. But definitely we all saw signs of it. Like I said, she should be, you know, she should be here in 5 minutes, and then 30 minutes later, where is she at? She got turned around. And so those conversations were definitely happening before the diagnosis, but that the diagnosis was definitely a punch in the gut for us.
Natalie, this is a fairly common dynamic, correct?
It really is. You know, as I mentioned, 110,000 Hoosiers are living with Alzheimer's or dementia, and about three times as many, 338,000 people in our state are providing unpaid care for someone with the disease. So caregiving is a huge issue in our journey, in our cause, and it's really important to consider those families and their part of this experience.
So if my math is correct, that means between 1 in 10 and 1 in 12 people mm-hmm. in Indiana is directly affected by Alzheimer's or dementia. Mary, you're nodding your head. My math skills are still good.
Your math skills are great, John, so I'm not worried about your calculation and your cognitive skills just yet. But I do want to say something and echo Sarah's comments. I hope the listeners are hearing this, that at 56 or 57, no one expected Mom to have these kind of issues, or at least that diagnosis. That is what we would call an early onset diagnosis, although it took them a while to get her in. So I have to say this loud and clear, is that there are these early onset diseases. One of my colleagues is just starting a huge study on the longitudinal early onset Alzheimer's disease study here at IU, and it's happening at about 16 other research centers across the country. So if anyone out there has any similar experience or questions their own cognition. We call that maybe mild cognitive impairment or subjective cognitive complaints, even though their spouse might say, you know, he's really pretty good. But the patient tells us, the person says, no, it's different than it was last year. I want everyone to pay attention to that and to really call us. I think with the way the research is going, the findings suggest that changes in the brain have probably started happening 15 to 20 years before we see them clinically, before we see those symptoms that Sarah's describing, so that her mom's brain was changing slowly for a long time. And we also have incredible research studies with the newer amyloid and tau imaging techniques with PET scanners and MRI scanners. We can see deposits of the abnormal proteins while the patient is alive in the scanner. The computerized images show us this. Even though you're doing perfectly well, we can see patterns of disease or these deposits that would suggest, I wouldn't be surprised in 5 or 10 years that this does progress. That gives us a whole new window on research, on treatment possibilities, on early interventions, all of the psychosocial, legal, family care planning stuff. If we could get our ducks in a row long before the symptoms appear.
Before it's at a crisis point.
Always try to plan before a crisis. Things will go much smoother for everyone involved. So I just think Sarah's story is so important and not that unique, I hate to say. But the sooner people ask those questions, recognize it, ask for help and support, the better off everyone will be.
We've got a tweet from a listener that's actually on point here. And again, if you want to join the conversation, you can do what this listener has done and reach out to us via Twitter at WFYI. You could also find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org or use the oldest system of all and call us at 866-476-3881. This listener writes, we ignore the elephant in the room, diet. It controls everything in our bodies. We have ignored it for years, and guess what? Can't remember. It's no joke. Mary?
You know, so I'm glad this came up because I kind of not lump diet, but I look at every time I do a talk or am meeting with people, I look at, well, so what do we know? What have we learned? And the big question is, what could we all do now? And I look at us in the studio. We're all of us at the age where we should have started working on this already. But your tweeter is absolutely right. So without prescribing anything, I do recommend to people really look at your diet. What we've learned is a heart-healthy diet is also good for brain health. Because we do look at, you know, that arterial sclerosis, hardening of the arteries, blood flow, diabetes and inflammation seems to be highly correlated to also diseases of cognition. We've learned that the MIND diet, which is kind of a mishmash between the Mediterranean diet and the American Heart Association DASH diet. If you start doing things like that, we tend to see beneficial results. Put another way, people that follow those diets for a long time in their lives tend to have less dementia later on. But it's not only that, it's also a little bit of exercise is very beneficial. And I count exercise both as physical, getting at least 20 to 60 minutes a day, get your heart rate up a bit. And I'm not saying anything that's going to take memberships or equipment, just a brisk walk every day.
Walk around the neighborhood if you need to.
Brisk walk would help us all. But I look at that's physical exercise. I also believe in cognitive exercise. I'm constantly thinking of knitting patterns, John, to keep your brain
healthy. And you are,
healthy.
In fact, knitting here in the studio.
I just knit anywhere I go. But anything that keeps your brain active. And again, not a huge investment. There's wonderful free games on your smartphones. There's things online you can do. Crossword puzzles are still great. Word games with the kids or the grandkids. So we've got physical exercise, cognitive exercise, and one we often forget. get is social exercise. Mm-hmm. Staying socially engaged, if that's with your family, with a bridge club, with your golf buddy, with a church group, so that you're not isolated and hiding away, but you're interacting. And then one that's, I mean, people, researchers are looking at it, but getting a lot more attention is sleep health and hygiene. That, you know, if we've anybody, a 20-year-old with poor sleep is going to have a bad day. If you have a 60-year-old with poor sleep, you know, their cognition is really going to be affected. Well, so, and we see a huge increase in sleep apnea. And apnea means you actually stop breathing during sleep. We need to be breathing, people. Oxygen is the food of the brain. So I think to the tweeter, it's all of that in combination. That I don't think we can really look at one of these in isolation.
Gotten another question via Twitter. This is from a listener named Bruce. And again, you can reach out to us via Twitter at NoLimitsWFYI. Bruce writes, we know that African Americans suffer higher rates of Alzheimer's than others. As a donor, my question is, does Alzheimer have specific programs and education marketing targeted to African Americans? Natalie.
That's a great question. And just to cite Bruce's comment, we know that African Americans are about twice as likely to develop Alzheimer's or dementia. And the Hispanic Latino population is about 1.5 times as likely. We don't necessarily have all the answers in terms of why that is, but we do, as an organization, you know, we've always reached out to these diverse communities to provide our programs and our services. At the Alzheimer's Association, we are placing a greater emphasis now in our new strategic plan on how we can reach out in ways that line up with those communities just a little bit more effectively. That, you know, I think we serve an audience that's pretty similar to the population, but knowing that those communities are more likely to be affected, we think we also need to serve a higher percentage of those communities than just the normal population. So that is a strategic goal for us, and it's something that we hope to do more in the future than we have in the past.
And I'm asking this question out of ignorance, but do we have some idea? I'm presuming that there have to be some cultural or other forces involved here in creating numbers that disproportionate. You could just write it off as an anomaly if it were, you know, a 2 or 3% difference, but 100% or 50% gains suggest that there is some force at work there. Correct, Mary?
Yes, I'd like to address that. So I wear another hat besides our Alzheimer's Disease Center. I happen to be the Associate Dean for Diversity Affairs at the School of Medicine. And this diversity issue cuts across so many things in terms of inequities and health, you know, injustices. And so our best guess at these differences in risk factors are really some of the previous questions. If you look at our African American and Hispanic Latino populations, risk for heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, all of those are much higher. And those are all the same risk factors that we also see for the dementing disorders. And so, and that can is easily traced back to diet, exercise, those types of things. And then, and this research was done here in Indianapolis. Our colleagues, Dr. Hendry and his group followed thousands, like 4,000 or 5,000 African Americans living in Center Township, Indy, and compared them to 4,000 or 5,000 Africans living in Ibadan, Nigeria. And what that was the first research that showed these huge discrepancies in prevalence and incidence. And they looked at it and they found certainly lifestyle differences, again, diet, exercise, and the differences were startling. We had 3 times the rates in Indy of these disorders than the Nigerians did. And we believed, if we looked at lifestyle, it was in Nigeria, they don't have access to and therefore do not eat red meat except maybe once or twice a year for a special festival. They live very much on legumes and root vegetables, and they're very much still an agrarian society, so they work very hard, very little body fat. They did blood tests and genetic sampling and found that APOE4 gene, so there's this gene that seems to be correlated with these higher risk factors, and it was much more prevalent in our African Americans than in the Nigerians. And that particular gene sits on the chromosome that codes for cholesterol. And that was where this diet and exercise and red meat and fats discussion started way back in the early 2000s. So there's many reasons why this happens. And I think the other important piece, and I think you asked it or the tweeter asked, is really reaching that population and increasing awareness, support, education, and services. And I know the association is working hard on that, and we at IU are working hard on that. And we've done some pilot studies together to reach the population and do many outreach programs in those neighborhoods just to increase awareness. And if we can get, you know, a handful of people changing diet and exercising. And the other key thing is adhering or following your doctor's directions. We know that there are so many patients that don't take their blood pressure meds, their heart disease meds, their diabetes meds. They either forget them, don't take them properly, which then escalates the problem.
We've gotten another question from a listener via Facebook. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. This is from a listener named Chris. It says, I feel like while there may be better diagnostic testing and other ancillary interventions that may help mitigate the risk of dementia, we are no closer to finding an actual cure for this terrible disease. Why is that?
I think she is very correct. I don't want to say we're no closer, because we're certainly a lot closer. We know a lot more than when I started in this field. I think the reason we don't have a single bullet, that magic bullet, everyone take this pill, is because it's such a complicated disease. It's not one single gene. We've identified multiple genes that seem to be related. Some of them are association or simply risk factor genes, increases the risk but doesn't guarantee we'll get it. We've got a few genes that are autosomal dominant that does indeed lead to this type of Alzheimer's disease. So I think it's just tremendously complicated. I believe we'll get there. I have to believe that. But it may not be a single one pill or one injection. I think it's going to be combination therapy. I think we've got to get early. I think it's going to be related to lifestyle changes. Many pieces of the puzzle have to fit.
Natalie, are the numbers going up or down in terms of diagnosis, or are they staying fairly static?
Unfortunately, the numbers are going up. And, you know, there are a couple of factors in play there. Number one, our population is aging. We're not dying from other conditions as early or as often, and so we're developing dementia later in life. Alzheimer's is the sixth leading cause of death, but of the top causes of death, it's the only one that currently has no way to be stopped, slowed, or prevented. So we unfortunately are seeing the numbers increase, and that's a huge burden on our society. There are a lot of costs associated with treating Alzheimer's and dementia and serving that population. So, you know, we actually are kind of on the brink, or we're in a public health and economic crisis because of this disease.
Is this a product? You know, alluded to the fact that people are living longer. I see some of the numbers, for example, like with diabetes, the projections are that, you know, depending on what study you look at, if you live long enough, you've got a 1 in 4, 1 in 3 chance of having diabetes. Is that the really driving factor, that we are just living longer?
I think that's one of them. One in three seniors dies with Alzheimer's or dementia. And as you age, you know, aging is the number one risk factor for these diseases.
We are talking about Alzheimer's in anticipation of this Saturday's Walk to End Alzheimer's. My guests are Sarah Bradley with Walk to End Alzheimer's, Natalie Sutton, who is the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Indiana, and Dr. Mary Guerrero Ostrom with the IU School of Medicine. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about Alzheimer's today on No Limits in anticipation of the annual Walk to End Alzheimer's, which is this Saturday. My guests are Sarah Bradley with the Walk to End Alzheimer's, Natalie Sutton, who is executive director of the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Indiana, and Dr. Mary Guerrero Ostrom of the Indiana University School of Medicine. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at wfyi. You also can do what a listener named Charles has done. Give us a call at 866-476-3881. Charles, you're on the air.
Hi, and hi to your guest. I have an observation. The doctor spoke about lifestyle changes and things necessary, possibly, as intervention. Mm-hmm. My mother is now suffering with Alzheimer's, and I actually have been watching her for the past 40 years, if you will. My graduate work had me dealing with using tools like yoga and meditation to help people to resolve hypertension, specifically for the community, ethnic community of African American. Mm-hmm. And what a doctor named Dr. Dean Ornish has done with respect to things like that is that he has found a way to reverse the plaques in heart disease. So he had people who had no other choice. They came to him, all arteries blocked, low fat, more like the diet that the doctor was speaking of, and gentle exercise like yoga, things like this, and they reversed the plaques. This is statistically significant research that the doctor can verify, but those kind of things are the kind of things that are necessary. And what's important is that I watched my mama and I talked to her because I have been eating mostly vegetarian since I've been an adult. And I would counsel her and say, Mama, don't eat that fat. She loved pigtails, legs. And I said, Mama, don't eat that fat. You got the fat? Give me the fat. And so I'm saying if plaques, and this is what this is something the doctor should put in their research thing and say, okay, if the plaques are doing this from our diet, then, again, my case is anecdotal, but I'm pretty sure that lifestyle and diet is a big player based upon my own personal research and research like Dean Ornish on things related. And so that's my input, hopefully to the ear of the doctor who said, audience, listen. I'm saying, okay, doctors, listen, and let's do some research to find out if the lifestyle changes, we can prevent this horrible condition.
Charles, thanks very much for calling and sharing that. We will get a response. But I don't want to let you go without wishing you and your mother well. And know that we are thinking of you. Thanks very much
Thank you very
for
much.
Calling. So, Mary.
Yeah, I'd like to thank Charles, right?
Charles,
for that call. And I want to reassure Charles and others that indeed our researchers are looking at those. And he said something very important. His description was anecdotal. He's been doing this with his mom. And so research can't be anecdotal. It needs to be these double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trials where one group changes the diet, one we watch them usual care, usual diet, and then if we see results, we switch. There's really scientific protocols that must be followed. And I want to assure people there's a tremendous longitudinal study called the Finger Trial out of Finland, I think, showed incredible results where they looked at all of those things we were talking about, diet, exercise, lifestyle interventions. It was so successful. The National Alzheimer's Association, the NIH, are funding a similar national trial here in the U.S. called POINTER. And we're looking at expanding that even further worldwide. So, yes, these are taken very seriously, and I believe we'll have incredible evidence to justify this. In the meantime, even before that evidence comes out, following a heart-healthy diet, and talk to your doctor about it. Don't make drastic changes, but just chat with your doctor, a dietitian, about making some of these changes, I think is good for anyone.
Well, and is it also, I mean, I was diagnosed with diabetes some years ago, and that first conversation when it becomes is sobering, because what you're hearing at this point from the doctor is that you have to change everything and give up everything that you love, when in fact, you know, once you get to the other side of it, you realize that's not the case. We just have to relearn moderation here. Right. In listening to Charles and his mother, part of what I think at least the mother was losing there is you're trying to take away stuff that I just absolutely love. And, you know, forever, that isn't the case. You just need to put some limits on it.
Exactly. And then I also like to say everything in moderation, even moderation. I don't want people to, you know, drive themselves nuts with this, but to really think about their choices. And that's something we can do and empower ourselves to do every day. And remember, there's no guarantees here. I'm often waiting for the caller, the tweet that says, yes, but, you know, my dad did everything right and he still got the disease. Mm-hmm. I know. And then, you know, I had a great uncle that did everything wrong and never got the
and
disease.
And he's still leaving.
He's 94. God bless him.
Still chugging along. Yeah.
Still chugging along. We just don't know. That's why that other tweet, that's why it's so hard to find that magic bullet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not one size fits all. You see so many different patterns of behavior, patterns of brain degeneration that we're trying to figure out this puzzle.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Amy. And again, if you want to join this conversation via email, you can send your email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Amy writes, "Hi, John, Natalie, and friends. The burden of organizing care and managing information within a family is overwhelming when also trying to care for your loved one. Caregiver burnout is something that is so real and is so hard. Thank you for reminding listeners to ask for and accept help. If listeners are struggling, What Friends Do is here to help organize the family and keep everyone updated on needs and situations. We love to help families and caregivers. Sarah, you were nodding your head in affirmation there.
I could not agree with her more. The caregiver burnout is real, and that's what the Alzheimer's Association is for, opening up resources and showing you that there are so many people who are dealing with the same experiences that you are. And unfortunately, Alzheimer's is not predictable, or it's not something that you expect to deal with. But knowing that there are so many people who have gone down that exact same road, whether it was 25 years ago or 5 minutes ago, our stories are so similar. And being able to experience this together and walk through this with the Alzheimer's Association has been such an honor for me.
Is it, and we probably ought to talk about the other pieces of this, because some of the care, it's not, you mentioned that your mother would push back mm-hmm. on that. I don't know what stage she's at now, but there's a person that occasionally I visit with who is living with dementia, and she will at times just look at her loved ones and say, "You're an idiot," you know, or something else that is equally abusive, which was completely out of character for here before the onset of the dementia. And yes, you'd like to be able to say, "I can put that aside," but no one likes to be called an idiot ever. That part of it, has it affected your relationship with your mother or the way you feel about her? And how do you go through dealing with that dynamic?
I think for me, I realized that every morning I woke up with a new amount of grace and patience to deal with the things that she was doing. I can't remember where I heard it from, but webinars or articles that I've read that she will be doing something today that annoys me or tests my patience, but she may not be doing those things tomorrow. So really being able to enjoy where she is today and not taking for granted the cognitive ability that she does have. She hasn't forgotten who I am yet, but I know that she will sometime. And just being able to love on her and experience where she's at today and being thankful that she is where she is today and still just really hoping for a cure so that other people on down the road don't have to deal with the things that I am dealing with.
Natalie, you mentioned earlier in the program that that your organization touts the 10 signs that people should look for. We would be remiss if we did not mention those 10 signs before the program ends.
That's a great suggestion. And, you know, we often hear that people say, "Well, I'm forgetting things and I'm just getting older," but really it's so much more than that. And so we like to talk when we do education programs, and it's maybe too lengthy of a conversation to go through all 10 and really, hone in on those right now. But the things that stick out to me are, it's not just forgetfulness, but it's almost not realizing what you've forgotten or not knowing how to retrace those steps and find that item that you might be missing if you've misplaced car keys or something along those lines. I think some of the experiences Sarah shared earlier with her mother where, it used to be so easy to get from point A to point B and she should have been here in 5 minutes, but she couldn't find her way there. And then I think the other thing, and Mary may have mentioned a little bit of this, are personality changes. So often we see that the person is really changing and they don't seem to be that person we know. And so those are a few of the things that I would encourage our listeners to look out for. I don't want to get too far beyond our last conversation. I think Amy made such a great point about asking for help. And it's something mm-hmm. that we, especially as a panel full of women and caregiving, can sometimes place an unlevel burden on women. But sometimes we have a really hard time asking for help. And I always like to just reinforce that there is help out there. At the Greater Indiana Chapter, we have 65 support groups throughout the state. We have education programs such as the 10 warning signs of Alzheimer's disease, or understanding Alzheimer's and dementia, or learning to live with Alzheimer's or dementia, or how to communicate with someone who has Alzheimer's or dementia. So we have a variety of education programs. And in addition, we have social workers on our team who meet with families one-on-one and provide care planning resources and support and connect and link people to other resources that they may need in the community, because those exist outside of our organization as well. So I would like to tell people the best way to access any of these resources, if you're out there and you need to ask for help, is to call our 24/7 helpline at 800-272-3900.
Go ahead and give that to them again, please.
Great. 800-272-3900. 3900.
I'm going to ask you also when we go off the air to plug that number in, and maybe a URL as well on our Facebook page, so that because sadly there are going to be people who are driving while they're listening
yes.
to this, and we discourage them from trying
That's
to write
me.
Things
yes.
trying to write things down while they are while they are driving. We've got a question from a listener named Elizabeth via Facebook. And again, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Elizabeth writes, just curious about how getting tested for Alzheimer's affects your insurance. Does Center for Aging perform MRIs?
That's a great question. So there's a Center for Aging Research, I think, at our Eskenazi Health and our Geriatric Medicine. I'm with the Indiana Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at IU School of Medicine, and IU Health has clinics for this. So there's two things. If you're calling us at the research center, all of these tests and diagnosis and workups and neuroimages, whatever you need, are provided free. So insurance is never contacted. So that's the research arm. And then there's certainly families come in for a diagnostic workup and see a neurologist or a geriatrician. So again, those diagnostic tests should be covered under most insurances. And it should not really affect care, quality of care. You know, I worry about the changing Obamacare and pre-existing conditions. And
I think that's what the email is speaking to.
Well, it should not affect that at all. I just don't know where this, this government, these issues are going. But certainly under the research arm, and if anybody is interested in that, these are sealed cases. These diagnoses or tests are never revealed.
Do you find that, Natalie, that people sometimes are reluctant to come forward and seek out the diagnosis because they're afraid of
absolutely
how it's going to affect their insurance or some other financial?
Well, I think people may be afraid of a number of things. They might be afraid of, you know, of that cost factor, or how are they going to get the care they need, or is it going to affect their insurance coverage for other issues or other health concerns? They might just be afraid of how their social network is going to respond, or how do they tell people about this, or might be afraid, you know, in some cases, in Sarah's story, her mom was still working, and people might be afraid of losing their jobs or
a loss of independence as well, not being able to do the things that they've always done.
Yeah. So I think there is a lot of fear involved in this. And again, I just always like to push forward that message of hope that, you know, there are things you can do and ways you can plan and ways you can live a quality life for as long as possible with this disease. And all of those are good reasons to seek out help and diagnosis.
And quickly, again, if people want to be involved in the walk on Saturday, how do they go about doing that?
They can go online. The website for the walk is act.alz.org/Indianapolis. So that's act.alz.org/Indianapolis. And I know that seems like a long address, but it will get you just to the right page for all the details on Saturday's walk in downtown Indianapolis. You can register online through tomorrow. You can make a contribution online. And if you don't get a chance to go there in advance, you can just join us at Bankers Life around 9 a.m. on Saturday morning.
Does it help, Sarah, to be around other people who are dealing with the things that you are dealing with?
More than you know.
And I'll ask this. I think I know the answer. Who are you going to be walking for on Saturday?
For my mom, Sue.
That is an appropriate last word, I think. I would like to thank my guests for what has been a lively and informative conversation. They are Sarah Bradley with Walk to End Alzheimer's, Natalie Sutton, who is the Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Indiana, and Dr. Mary Guerrero-Ostrom of the IU School of Medicine. Thank you all for being here. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
And I'd like to thank our listeners. It's always a pleasure doing talk radio for the smartest audience in radio. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.